Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With the Venezuelan elections underway this Sunday, we will begin with an analysis of how elected autocrats like Hugo Chavez and Vladimir Putin are able to use the tools and outward appearance of democracy to install permanent power and rule. William Dobson, the politics and foreign affairs editor of Slate and the former editor of Foreign Policy, joins us to discuss his latest book, The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Then we'll examine the duplicity of our Saudi allies who are sending Salafist jihadists to Syria with the intention of toppling the Assad regime and replacing it with a reactionary Islamic theocracy. Dr. Ali Al-Yami, the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, joins us to discuss the divergent interests of Saudi Arabia and the U.S. in supporting the Syrian rebels and how our foreign policy establishment have not seemed to notice that the Saudis nurtured the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and are radicalizing Pakistan to the detriment of the United States. Then finally, we will speak with Barbara Garson, the author of a new book, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. We will discuss the resilience of the American people in the face of the shameful fact that in America, the rich are getting richer and the poor poorer, and assess the state of economic justice and social responsibility as more of our citizens lose their homes and jobs to predatory banks and vulture capitalism. And joining us now is William Dobson, who's the politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate. He's also been an editor at Foreign Affairs, Newsweek International, and Foreign Policy. During his tenure at Foreign Policy, the magazine was nominated for the National Magazine Award for General Excellence each year and won top honors in 2007 and 2009. His latest book, just out in paperback, is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Dobson.
Thank you for having me.
And there is a new phenomenon clearly in the world today, and that is the elected autocrat. The assumption was, particularly when the Cold War ended, that when democracy triumphed, it would survive. But democracy in many ways has merely become a means, or elections. You know, if you have elections, that's democracy. So let's start with that question. Clearly, elections don't mean democracy.
That's right. There's much more in the DNA of a democracy than the fact that people go to a specific location on a specific day and mark a ballot. The most sophisticated when it comes to electoral authoritarian regimes or dictatorships is one like Venezuela. And that's because, you know, unlike so many places around the world today, the elections in Venezuela are actually, for the most part, pretty free and fair. The problem is not election day, it's every other day of the year where the regime is able to make sure that there isn't equal access to media, that there is intimidation subtly to keep people from voting their will or keeping people from coming to the polls, that there are a distribution of benefits so as to make sure that the playing field is never level between parties. So, you know, what we find in a broad sense is that today's authoritarians or modern-day dictators, they understand that they're working in a globalized world and that the more brutal forms of intimidation, mass arrests, firing squads, things of that nature, are best replaced with more subtle forms of coercion. And in fact, even tools of democracy can be very subtle forms of coercion.
Obviously, Putin comes to mind. We'll certainly talk about him. But let's stay with Venezuela since there's an election this Sunday. And my understanding is that the playing field is far from level in terms of media access. For the longest time, the Chavistas have basically controlled almost all of the media except for Globovision, which was the one independent media and the only place you could ever even hear about the candidate Capriles in the last election. Now, Chavistas, through a front man, have bought out the shares of Globovision.
That's right. That's right. So this will be the last election that Globovision ever reports on in a meaningful way. And with that sale going through right after, it's supposed to go through right after the election, that'll be it. In many ways, and this was something that, in the case of Venezuela, in fact, you know, it's kind of we remember Chavez as a very media savvy leader, and he certainly was. But in fact, you know, this was something that he came to rather late. It was only after 2002, a few years into his rule, that he realized how much he did not have control of the media landscape in Venezuela. So, it, like many parts of the experiment that has been Chavismo for Venezuela, it's a story of the deterioration of what was once a democracy, and the media front is just one way in which you see the country having lost many of the independent government offices and accountability that it once had. I mean, because the thing that he understood from the beginning is that he needed to centralize power, and so all power was centralized through Chavez, which is what makes this moment so difficult even for Chavistas. It's still very unclear what will follow in the wake of Chavez now that he's no longer there. But he quickly consolidated all government offices, the military, the Supreme Court, everything under his control, and the media actually came later. In the case of, in other cases, like you see in a place like, for example, Russia, the media came much earlier in that story. But it's unfortunately something that in all these places they understand generally that there is some aspect of the media landscape that they want to keep free. This is even true in a place like China, for example, where in China certainly media isn't free. But if there's any area where the media has given a little bit more latitude, it's been in financial journalism. And that's because the government actually wants to know who is egregiously corrupt. They know almost everyone is corrupt, but they need to know who is egregiously corrupt. And the fact is having journalists is a really good way of getting information, even about your own country. So you'll see limited ways. In Russia, you see it on the internet. One area which is still relatively free, or largely free, is the internet in Russia, but not so in other areas. So you have to actually, and this is true generally about authoritarian regimes, no matter what you're discussing, you have to look very closely because the situation can be very varied. But if you pull back enough, you can see commonalities across them.
Again, I'm speaking with William Dobson, the politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate. He's been an editor at Foreign Affairs, Newsweek International, and Foreign Policy. And his latest book, just out in paperback, is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. So give us a sense then of, since the elections are happening in Venezuela this Sunday, and there was some talk about international monitors not being allowed in, but I believe the Carter Center are going down there. Maduro, the successor, of course, has put out a curse on anybody who votes for Capriles.
Yeah.
But you mentioned not just the media control that the Chavistas have, but they also have other techniques. I understand that they control, or they have access to the entire voting rolls, and that they spread them amongst their supporters to intimidate people who may not show up, for this case Maduro, vote for the bourgeois candidate, as they call him,
right.
Capriles.
Well, in some ways, I mean, you can find some tools in Venezuela which should be familiar to, you know, any American, for example, who grew up in the American South. And, you know, I grew up in South Carolina. And if you come from certain parts of the United States, you're very familiar with gerrymandering. And that is something that in Venezuela they've taken to an art. And so again, you know, in the case of a democratic system like the United States, there can be elements in which the system where there's a deep degree of one-party control in certain areas. Now, that's just happens to be the case across Venezuela. So you have those techniques, which is, you know, in some ways not that surprising or shocking, even if the results are, you know, alarming. But then you have other things that you've seen over the course of this last 10 years, which the residual effects are still really there. So, in one instance, when I was doing the reporting for the book, I was on a street corner in downtown Caracas, and someone came up to me to sell what I thought were going to be DVDs. Now, this is actually not a very uncommon experience. What happened to me was that I found out that they weren't DVDs that the person was selling. Rather, it was voting lists. And so for about $1.50, I was able to purchase the voting history of about 5 million Venezuelans. And what that meant was I had not just their names, their home addresses, but I had their voter ID numbers and how they had voted in a series of recent referendums and elections. Now, this information was publicly available because at one point early on, Chavez said, look, I'm concerned that some of the signatures are forgeries. So we're going to publish the list. And this became known as the Tascon list because that was the name of the official who put it online. And it was quickly taken down, but it had been released effectively. And so it's in a polarized political system like Venezuela, this is incredibly important information because essentially if a country is divided along pro and anti around one figure like Chavez, then the government knew that if everyone had this information, they knew behaviorally how they would use it, which is that imagine you're a small businessman and you have an opening for a position. Do you want to hire someone who everyone knows has voted against the government several times? I mean, when it gets down to decisions as to who's going to get audited or who's going to get a visa or a passport or who's going to have particular medical care, this is the type of information that can be used against you. And not even if you are anti-Chavez, you could still say, you know what, I don't like this government, but I don't want to be hassled by it. So effectively, what the regime does through fear within a polarized system is they get their own citizens to persecute their neighbor and to essentially discriminate against them politically. It's incredibly savvy, incredibly sophisticated. And what's really important is that most Venezuelans, even though I think most people in the Carter Center included would say, look, there's no evidence of outright fraud or ballot stuffing like we see in some, like a Central Asian dictatorship, for example. Nothing like that, no. But at the same time, how much does it matter if more than 50% of the country thinks that the ballot isn't secret, which is the case, or that more than 50% believe that if they do vote in a particular way that the government doesn't favor, that there could be consequences for them, as people there do. So, in effect, they're able to accomplish their aims while not actually getting their hands that dirty after all.
So let's turn to Russia, because you mentioned the first thing that Putin did was to take over the media, got rid of Berezovsky and got rid of Gazinsky. And there is a kind of figment of an alternative press there, but it's very, very narrow with Novaya Gazeta and Moscow Echo. And you mentioned that he hasn't been able to take over the internet yet. And of course, the FSB watch the internet and they have their own people on the internet, just as the Chinese do, the so-called 50 cents brigade in China, where right. They put out pro-government propaganda and get paid 50 cents a pop. But I've always been astounded, actually, and it wasn't until Marcia Gessen's book came out, The Man Without a Face, that I think the true portrait of who Putin is has come out. Why did Bush stare into his eyes and saw his soul and thought he was a good guy? And why did everybody give this guy, and to some extent they still do, give him a break when it looks like he's a gangster in charge of KGB Incorporated?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a fascinating question as to why did people have faith in this figure? And I think in large part, if you go back to 2000 and the beginning of the Putin era, in large part, it was just because people didn't know. I mean, he was an inscrutable figure, and people did not, there was nothing that was so clear. There was no smoking gun that gave a clear sense of who this man was going to be. In fact, that was very much a moment where Russia was at a crossroads, and there was nothing that was necessarily predetermined about the way that Putin would rule. It is something that sort of slowly, over time, unveiled itself. And I think that it is true that almost every step of the way, despite all previous information or all evidence to the contrary, people continually gave him the benefit of the doubt that certainly he couldn't be doing this. Certainly Medvedev's presidency is entirely a sham. Certainly he doesn't really mean to lock this man up for more than a decade. Certainly, and again and again and again. And that's part of it. The other reason is that many of his early moves, many of them were actually quite subtle and sophisticated, and you have to give him some credit for the way that he's operated. I mean, you take the Russian Constitution itself. I mean, despite how illiberal this government is, he has never really done direct, horrible violence to the Russian Constitution. I mean, this is a man who didn't say, you know what, I'm going to tear up this document like so many Latin American caudillos before me and just let myself become president for life. No, okay, there are rules in place. I can serve two terms, and then I can't serve a third term consecutively, so I'll step down. And there's no reason for me to do anything so glaring as to sort of announce myself as a president for life, you know, because he understands the value in keeping his costs low and at the same time working effectively. You know, in the case of, say, the Russian parliament, the Duma, everyone knows, I interviewed members of the Duma themselves who would say that they were essentially a rubber stamp body. But Putin understood that in having made this legislature toothless, and he lost something. And what he lost in doing that, something that all overly centralized regimes lose, is he lost the valuable information about whether or not ideas, legislation was popular or not. Because if nothing else, a legislature gives you information. It gives you a citizen reaction to ideas and proposals. And so he created a separate institution called the Public Chamber, which its role is in many ways to give him that information. There are experts in media, law, even civil society that are appointed to the Public Chamber. And that's the key difference, is that they're appointed. So ultimately, they can't actually challenge him in any real political sense. And he did that because he wanted to shore up a blind side that he had, that because of the way he was centralizing power. This is not like so many North African or Middle Eastern regimes where it's, you know, dynastic or nearly dynastic. No, this is a man who's actually observing procedures and protocol and law in many respects. But if you look very closely, you see how, in fact, it's an enormous accumulation of power for one man only.
So, William Dobson, what is it then about democracy and the democratic system that is so easy for these people like Chavez and Putin to game? Now, of course, in Russia's case, it didn't have democracy, mm-hmm. and it had it briefly under Yeltsin, right. And that was a catastrophe for the people.
Right.
And then under Chavez, of course, you had oligarchical governments prior to that who only represented the very rich. So, you know, obviously, both in Putin's case and in Chavez's case, there's enormous popular support for these leaders. But what I'm curious about is, how is it that you have these particular individuals who have determined to have absolute power through a democratic process? Why isn't there sufficient pushback? Is democracy by nature a frail institution if somebody that's determined like Putin and Chavez to capture it?
It's by its very nature a highly imperfect thing. I mean, even in the U.S. Democratic system, we have elements to our system which are anything but democratic. I mean, you take the Federal Reserve, or you take the Electoral College itself. Not a particularly democratic institution in the way that it operates and some of the distortions that it creates. So you have what is a highly imperfect system, which, if you have a soft touch, if you're able to navigate the seams of a democratic system, you are able to exploit it to great advantage. So it's a very effective public relations tool as well, because, if I were a member of the Venezuelan government, and you'll hear this from members of the Venezuelan government, I would constantly be pointing out the irregularities within the U.S. democratic system. And they're true, and they're real. Those irregularities exist. And so you're able to have a fairly, effective tit-for-tat debate or conversation about, well, you say my system's not democratic, well, what about your own? But what you ultimately have to look at is sort of how rules are actually executed. I mean, go back to the example you made earlier about Global Vision. Well, I mean, the government of Venezuela say, well, look, I mean, someone's buying the station. This is a this is something capitalists around the world should celebrate. This is a contract between a buyer and a seller. We don't have any role in this. Now, that's just not true, in the sense that it's being bought by someone that's friendly to the regime, and we understand that there's going to be there's consideration for that. But nevertheless, on its face, nothing is untoward. Is this sort of gray zone between how rules are written and how they're applied that these governments are able to exploit very, very effectively? As one Russian dissident in Moscow put it to me, she said, look, my constitution is every bit as good as yours. The only difference is that although my constitution has all these rights written into it, the only right that's actually observed is my right to leave.
Well, let's turn. There's so much to cover here, and we haven't covered China. It was barely mentioned. And I did an interview recently with a Chinese scholar who was pointing out the extraordinary endemic corruption in the very top levels of the Chinese government. And we know about from Bloomberg and New York, the New York Times, about how these former leaders have become multi-billionaires through their families of princelings. But for example, the top 90 people in the equivalent of the Congress in China have a collective wealth of $89.9 billion. And that if you could combine the total wealth of everybody in the House and Senate, White House, the Cabinet, and the Supreme Court, it comes out at $7.5 billion. And arguably, the Supreme Court has enabled oligarchs to buy our government. That's another conversation. But the truth of the matter is that China is incredibly corrupt. But what's happening, the pushback there is very interesting from what they call the netizens, citizens on the use the net, and they take photographs of bureaucrats and government officials of the wristwatches to see who's wearing a $60,000 Rolex. And they so give us a sense of, we know about how these autocrats can take over with soft power, if you will. But let's talk about the pushback and what's happening in China.
Sure. I mean, in many ways, everything you say about the incredible levels of corruption in China is absolutely true. When the revelations from New York Times came out about Wen Jiabao, I mean, what was maybe most stunning about that, besides the actual sums that his family has accumulated, is the fact that he's supposed to be the good one. And if he has $3 billion or nearly $3 billion through his family, what does that say for those that we have a less charitable view of within the Politburo? So there's no question that the corruption there is incredible. What's really interesting to look at is what you're pointing to, which is the cat and mouse between the people and the government there. And one of the things I give the Chinese government credit for, from just looking at them objectively and sort of how the system that they run, is that this is a system that understands what its vulnerabilities are. They are aware of the fact that corruption is something that really goes right to the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party's right to rule. And so they're going to go to great lengths, and they're going to great lengths to squash people's understanding or familiarity with the types of criminality associated with the regime. They understand that if people actually do rise up in China, that if there was ever to be something like a Tiananmen Square again, that they will likely not be able to survive. And so they go to great lengths to prevent that from happening. They are thinking about the future in a way that I just didn't see in my reporting in other places. And it's one thing that every place I went, everyone always talked about China, because these other governments were trying in some small way to try to emulate them. One of the things that's maybe most stunning, or sort of to go back and sort of their own history as to, you know, what was a cleavage point, I think it really was sort of these twin shocks of both Tiananmen Square and then the collapse of the Soviet Union. And how China responded to that is very different from what we expect or see in other places, which is that in light of these sort of shocks to their system, both domestically and in an international ally like the Soviet Union, the government in China didn't respond by closing its borders or shutting itself off or building bigger walls, but rather they opened themselves up. And they looked very carefully and closely at the example of the Soviet Union to do a real autopsy of sort of why that regime had failed. And then having studied it very closely, having sent researchers and academics across all of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, they came back and said, we will do exactly the opposite of what was done there. And so that's when you begin to see a great deal of opening up. And you see the fundamental contract between the government and the citizenry change, that's really where you begin to see a change where they say, look, do not challenge us, and we will essentially get ourselves out of your life. We will give you more room to prosper as long as you don't challenge the political monopoly of the Chinese Communist Party. And they've done that very effectively. Now, will they be able to continue to do this? I think it just becomes incredibly difficult with time for them to maintain this act. There's so many challenges that that government faces on a daily basis, and so many areas where one of their key sort of techniques begins to break down, which is people communicating across society. To some degree, although we've seen an enormous upsurge in protests in China, the government doesn't worry about them too much if they remain localized affairs or they remain among one segment of society, students, workers, what have you. It's when these groups begin to organize across society that you see a real concern from the point of view of the government. And that's exactly the sort of thing you're beginning to see in protests that are springing up in China over the environment. Because the environment isn't something that just affects workers or students, but it brings these groups together across. And when they do that, that's the making of a real civil society. And that's ultimately the Chinese Communist Party's nightmare.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, William Dobson.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William Dobson, who's the politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate. He's been an editor at Foreign Affairs, Newsweek International, and Foreign Policy. And during his tenure at Foreign Policy, the magazine was nominated for the National Magazine Award for General Excellence each year and won top honors in 2007 and 2009. His latest book, just out in paperback, is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how our Saudi allies have different plans for Syria after Assad. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who is the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, a native of Saudi Arabia who has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Ali Al-Yami.
Thank you.
So I reported recently on a story where a Saudi judge had given a group of young dissidents a choice, either to go to jail or to go fight jihad in Syria. And one of these young fighters was killed, and his father has sued the judge. But it sort of reminded me of how little things have changed in Saudi Arabia, because that was the same methodology that went on during the jihad in Afghanistan involving bin Laden and others, where a lot of these repressive regimes like Saudi Arabia exported all their dissidents to go off and fight jihad. So how much is this happening in Saudi Arabia today?
Well, I mean, the Saudi religious establishment is part of the Saudi government. They wield power, as much power as the ruling family wants them to have. But they do encourage Saudi people to go and defend Islam, whatever that means. So these people who are already indoctrinated from their education, from home, from the mosque, from universities like Imam Muhammad ibn Saud University in Riyadh and Umm al-Qura in Mecca and Islamic University in Medina. These are Saudi government universities. So they encourage them to go and defend Islam wherever they think that Islam or Muslims are being threatened. So there is nothing new in this, and I'm not really sure about this judge who give people. I don't think the story, the way you stated it, is correct. For example, the judge would not just round people from the streets and tell them either you go to They didn't need to do that because they have enough people without having to give them choices. You go to jail or go to jihad, because a lot of young Saudi, unfortunately, men and women now are already brainwashed into doing what the religious establishment tells them to do when it comes to defending their faith.
Well, this 22-year-old who died in Syria, his name was Muhammad al-Talq. He was arrested and found guilty of participating in a demonstration in the north-central Saudi town of Burada. And the judge apparently gave them a reason to go fight in Saudi Arabia. And 11 of the 19 protesters left to join the rebels. And that's the judge who the father of this boy that was killed is suing. So this is a story by Rhys Ehrlich in Global Post. He's fairly reliable, so I don't know whether...
I'm not saying that the Saudi judges are extreme people themselves. The Saudi judicial system is based on the interpretation of these clerics who are extremists, and I wouldn't do anything. They would do anything. And it is possible that these people were arrested in Breda because they are demonstrating there against the system, incarcerating their relatives without charges or a trial, and that's normal procedures in Saudi Arabia. I'm not saying that this judge or particular judge have not done something like this, but my issue with it would not be a government policy. The Saudi government policy, because they didn't need to give people choices. All they have to do is to give them the green light, and they will just go and fight wherever they want them to fight. The Saudi judicial system is a religious extremist system that doesn't recognize the human rights, women's rights, religious minority rights, non-Muslim rights. They feel their religion or their interpretation of religion is supreme, and all other beliefs and other religions are the religions of the gutters. That's their thinking and their mentality, and therefore I have no doubt that they are capable of doing anything, including the story you just told me.
Well, apparently the Saudi Arabians and the Qataris aren't on the same page. The recent summit in Doha broke up with acrimony between the Saudis and the Qataris over who they're supporting in terms of the Free Syrian Army and their efforts to topple the Assad dictatorship in Syria. The Saudis apparently support the Salafists, and I believe this fellow that we're talking about went off to fight for the al-Nusra Front, which is sort of often referred to in the Western press as al-Qaeda affiliated, and that the Qataris support the Muslim Brotherhood. So what is Saudi Arabia's motive then, if they're supposedly an ally of the United States, in supporting the most hardline elements in the Free Syrian Army? Do they want Syria to end up as a theocracy?
Oh, absolutely. The Saudis are exporting their ideology everywhere in the world, including in this country, which is a very big threat to our own democracy and liberty in America. This is not any more hidden. This is a fact of life. Yes, the Saudi government is supporting the Salafi extremists. In fact, according to a Yemeni newspaper, and I have the article on that, a Yemeni newspaper some 2 or 3 months ago interviewed some of the members of the Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula, and during the interviews, they found out that the Saudi government is recruiting members of the Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula to go and fight in Syria. This is something that I found not new based on what I know about the Saudi regime. But they are the one who are asking us and asking the world to fight Al-Qaeda because they consider them a threat. In the meantime, when they need them, they go and recruit them to go and fight these dirty wars like the one in Syria. So the Saudis want an extremist theology in Syria just like they did in Afghanistan in the 1980s and 1990s. They have created this Taliban movement in Afghanistan. So the Qataris you know, both of them, both the Qatari regime and the Saudi regime, are absolute regimes that are American allies and under our protection. I happen to believe, if it's not for the U.S. protection and the British and the French protection, these governments would have fallen long time ago. But they are, the Qataris want to, they are supporting the Qataris and the Turks and, you know, I beg your pardon. The Qataris are supporting the Muslim Brothers, because the Muslim Brothers is seen by governments, including our own, as a moderate Islamist group. So it is they will be less harmful than, let's say, the Salafis, the Saudis, and the Jordanians, the United Arab Emirates are supporting in Syria. So the Syrian war is being fought and on behalf of external powers, the Turks, the Saudis, and everybody else. But that's why. The Saudis want a total theocratic regime in Syria. The Qataris want something like the Muslim Brothers, which is not extremist in their views. In my views, they are extremist. And it is safer to support that group, because it's also a very powerful group, the Muslim Brothers. So they feel they will prevail regardless what they do.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who is the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, a native of Saudi Arabia, has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reform in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. So the United States and Saudi Arabia are allies, and yet Saudi Arabia's motives in Syria are the direct opposite of what the United States says that they want in Syria. They want to get rid of a dictatorship and help install a democracy. Surely the United States must know what's going on. Why can't they do something about it?
Well, we are doing something about it, as far as I know, and I could, you know, see going on. Of course, the Saudis now, they have a tremendous influence in the United States, whether it is the educational institutions, civic organizations, think tanks, the Pentagon, Congress, everywhere. They have the money, they have the oil, and a lot of people, unfortunately, will go along with the Saudis. So they have this economic, and we are in an economic tough situation now. We need the Saudi oil at reasonable prices, and we need some cash to keep our treasury afloat. So for that reason, we are being cowed by the Saudis. However, I want to give the administration some credit. If what I know and what I hear and what I understand is true, the reason that the United States haven't actually, or has not, or our administration has not come on the side of the rebels in Syria directly is because we don't want the groups that the Saudis are supporting, these extremists, to gain power. Therefore, we have stayed away from supporting the rebels directly. And I think many people in and outside of government, including the people who don't like the administration, realize that probably the best choice we have among very bad choices. So the administration is withholding direct involvement in Syria because they know, we know, or our politicians know, and I hope they do, and CIA and others, they know that the ones who are gaining the upper hand at this point in this fight are extremist, Saudi-supported religious groups. And that's why we haven't got exactly involved directly. Otherwise, I think we could have gotten involved like we did in Libya.
Well, that sort of doesn't make sense, though, Dr. Al-Yami, because if you don't support the moderate and more democratic elements in the Syrian opposition, and the Saudis are supporting the extremists, then the people who get the support will end up in charge of the country after.
Yeah, right.
Just in the last couple of minutes, let's turn to Saudi Arabia. And do you think that there's any signs, given what's happened in the rest of the Middle East with the Arab Spring, any signs of any dissident movements beginning in Saudi Arabia? Or having any chance. I know it's an incredibly repressive regime and that we sort of support unconditionally and that they use their money around the world to influence us to think that they're not as hideous a regime as they really are. But within the country itself, is there any signs of hope?
Oh, absolutely. There are. I mean, look, none of the regimes in the Arab countries is going to survive this revolutionary trend. And the reason for that, for the first time in their history, the Arab people are focusing on their own home growing misfortunes instead of blaming colonialism and blaming Zionism and blaming Christians and blaming Crusaders. They are taking into the streets to rid themselves from these dictators and these corrupt dictators in their own countries. And nobody is going to stop them. And this is the easiest part of all of this, is to actually get rid of these dictators. That's the easiest first step. The more difficult one, and it's going to take years to come, is to transform the not only the institutions, the economic institutions, social, political, and religious institutions to meet the demand of the 21st century. It's going to take social and cultural and even mental transformation of the people who have known nothing except religious and political totalitarianism for the last 15 century. So we have to discount and seeing these revolutions going back and forth and up and down. The Saudi regime is more threatened and less stable today than it has ever been in its history, regardless of what we do in this country or Europe. The people of Saudi Arabia, just like the other people in Tunisia and Egypt and Syria and Lebanon and everywhere else in Yemen and Bahrain, they are, and Kuwait, they are going to be moving towards dismantling of this regime, not because you and I wish it or don't wish it. The people inside Saudi Arabia are the ones who want it, and it's already happening. There are the demonstrations, as you mentioned, in Breda. These are, interestingly enough, Breda is the source of the Saudi power and legitimacy. That's where Wahhabism was born and it came from and legitimized. Mothers and daughters and sons and fathers and children demonstrating against the very same system they support because they feel that the system is too harsh on their own relatives. Some of them are religious extremists from what I read in the Saudi media, and some are liberal who went to some democratic reforms. They are all gathered, thrown in jail, no charges and no trials. Their families want them either out or charged and tried in open courts, and Saudi Arabia doesn't allow open court. It's all over secret trials. So that there is that in Breda, the center of the country. And for the first time, the Saudi regime is, because it's panicky, they are actually rounding up women and children and put them in jails with their relatives, the one these families want to get out of prison. And that is a sign of the system's panicky. There is a demonstration and everywhere in the country, not only in eastern Saudi Arabia, where the majority of demonstrations are taking place among the religious minorities who are oppressed because of their religious orientation. There are demonstrations in the south, the Asir region, which is the more agricultural area. A few months ago, university student women demonstrated, and some of them got hurt and jailed and, I believe, killed. There are demonstrations in the capital and schools for equality. So it's all over the place, regardless what our media doesn't say, because our media is purchased by the Saudis, or they go along the line of our foreign policy in the Middle East, like the Washington Post and New York Times and other. They didn't give you the real day-to-day information about what's happening in that country. And then you have the think tanks that analyze things because they read books and they think they know it all. And nobody, none of these groups predicted the Arab Spring or the Arab Revolution. None of them predicted it because they didn't know. Those of us who were born there and lived there and understand there, and we make it our business to study what's going on for years and years and years, we know these things are happening. It's going to happen in Bahrain. It's already happening in Bahrain. It will happen in Qatar, it will happen in Kuwait, it will happen in Oman, it will happen in Saudi Arabia, it will happen. There is no stopping to this. It doesn't make any difference what we want or don't want. And I think it will be prudent on our side, I'm talking about the United States, and the West, and Western Europeans, it's in our best interest to support pro-democracy, secular movements, especially women. Women is, I believe, women is our best, or are our best allies. And I think if we support them, that will do great work for the people of the Middle East and for the United States national interest and security.
Well, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who is the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. He's a native of Saudi Arabia who has lived in the United States for many years, where he's advocated for political reform in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession.
كان ما بتلاير فيه ولا خطري كل الظهرك عنده حكي جريء قدامك شخص بريء من وين جيت من وين نبات بالمدينة انتكر فيها الحب والحب حب الخلايا نامت وما عدت فيه جيت من رواية الحي نظيف الكل يوم شوف فيه زبالة ولا وسخ عم تلعب على الطريق شوف في راس معقد
Oh the grocers though we have fun Tax collectors getting closer Still we have fun There's nothing surer. The rich get rich and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Barbara Garson, the author of four books, including All the Live Long Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work, The Electronic Sweatshop, How Computers Are Transforming the Office of the Future, and Money Makes the World Go Round, One Investor Tracks Her Cash Through the Global Economy. She has also written several plays, including McBird and the Obie Award-winning The Dinosaur Door. Her latest book just out is Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barbara Garson.
Thank you.
And there was just a report out recently on homelessness in the United States, and apparently there have been some improvements made with homeless vets because the White House has intervened on that score. But apparently amongst our poorest citizens, the numbers are increasing, and that every night over 600,000 Americans are homeless.
Well, gosh. You know, I kind of wondered myself. I mean, you know, down the up escalator is personal accounts. I have some statistics on jobs and incomes, but I wondered about, I sat with one woman, I met her sort of in court in the morning, where she said to the judge, her house was being foreclosed, and she said, when will this happen, Your Honor? When will they come for me? And he just pointed to the bank's attorneys and said, the house belongs to them. It was such a dramatic iambic. And she was a home care worker. I just saw her in court and asked if I could speak to her. She had to go right back to work. But I met her that evening. And, I mean, I spent the evening talking to somebody who didn't know where she lived the next day. She would say, like, I think the sheriff will hold you stuff for 10 days. And, I mean, I didn't meet many people in that circumstance. I have to say that. I met many people in great insecurity negotiating with their banks. But this woman had actually owned her house and had it paid fully in the 1980s. At that point, she had a regular job. What's disappearing, you know, where you work 40 hours and they give you the pay and they give you the benefits, and she knew what her salary is going to be. When that closed, she became a home care worker, which means she had a very insecure income, although she's the big, strong lady and got a lot of jobs. And so the more insecure her income was, the more banks were willing to lend her money at that period. So eventually she fell for one of these, you know, your house is now worth not $35,000, but $235,000, $300,000. This is Richmond, California. And she eventually, you know, with door people ringing her doorbell every night and letters and telephone calls, when her children finally left home, her second child, she decided to mortgage the house, fully owned, remember, and put a down payment on homes for each of them. She knows that was a mistake. I'm not saying she was, you could call her a speculator, couldn't you, a housing speculator. But eventually she lost that house through, well, you know what happened. The same people, ghettos were redlined, remember. But once the bankers discovered how to sell bad mortgages, bundling together, the same districts became redlined in the opposite direction. That is, the big banks gave almost unlimited money to the hustlers who had formerly been in the ghetto, and they started this business. And so here was this woman. Yes, she was going to be homeless. In fact, I tried. She kept thinking, maybe I could call another lawyer, maybe I could do something. And I tried to turn her mind to, let's think of who you could stay with. And it turns out she hadn't even told her children that this was going on.
Well, unfortunately, Barbara Garson, this is the result of the housing collapse, of course, which resulted in a near-death experience in the global economy. And, of course, Wall Street has been made whole, the very people who did
exactly.
Made these predatory loans. But the great tragedy, of course, was that the people who were victims, by and large, were aspirants to the middle class, poorer Americans who saw this way up. And remember, our former president, George W. Bush, boasted about the ownership society.
Right, the ownership society. And actually, this woman had actually been in it for briefly. And I only slowly began to put together another part of the story that was true about almost everyone I interviewed, which was she had already been going down. In other words, she had already moved from being a regular worker to a contractor, an entrepreneur, you might say. In other words, she had a very insecure income as a home care attendant. And in the same period, that what I began to see is that for 40 years, incomes have been stagnant or declining. And so the banks, and yet productivity has been going up immensely in those same years from, say, 71 to 2007, where income was increased by 4%, not over 36 years, but over 4% but 36 years. So here is this woman who's like everybody else's income is down, productivity is up. That was really very profitable for people who owned companies, people who were investors, and a lot of money accumulated in these banks and in brokerage funds. And you know, a bank can't keep its money in the bank. So what I began to see is that these crazy loans were a form of saying, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to pay you to buy what you produce, but I'll lend you the money. And I mean, that can only go on so long. And I'm not sure you have to call the banker stupid who did it. He had to do something. And he hoped he would get rid of the loans, and he didn't do it in time. And as you said, the government made him whole. So in a sense, he did get rid of the loans. That 1%, 99%, it's the huge accumulations on one hand and other people not being able to do their little jobs as buyers. And I gradually, but only slowly, began to see bits of that in everyone's story, why they were indebted, or regardless of their personal feelings, they really were moving down, whether they thought it was their fault or not.
Again, I'm speaking with Barbara Garson, the author of four books, her latest being Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. And, of course, the overall, since you've talked to so many people and provided us with a window into the sort of forgotten Americans, if you will, the truth of the matter is that this recovery that we keep talking about, and frankly, what little recovery has happened is being mendaciously stalled and thwarted by the Republicans, which is shameful. I wish the White House would point out to the American people that they really are actively sabotaging the economy because of their hatred of Obama and because they are so much in the thrall of the billionaires and millionaires who pay their way.
I feel the same way. Here I've written this book. Is it really my job to point out basic Keynesianism? I mean, come on. Let him talk about redistributing a little money. Let me talk about, nationalizing the wealth so that we could really decide where to build homes instead of letting bankers just lend money for construction. But, I mean, I can't believe that I have to say these things. That's the Democrats' job to talk about, getting enough money around in the middle of a depression to start the economy going again.
So,
but they're not.
This is what's so frustrating. But just in the last minute or so, Barbara Garson, give us a sense of, you've brought these extraordinary stories to us, which make us realize how this social engineering that has benefited the rich and made the rich richer and the poor poorer has impacted America today. What was your final kind of takeaway, if you will, given the extraordinary pain that you've documented here? And of course, you've also documented the resilience.
That's right. I mean, my final thing, capitalism stinks, but people are something else. I mean, it's still a book full of people. They still have stories, and I like writing them. It's terrible to say I enjoyed their stories, but I did.
And what is your sense then of our future, both the country and the American people, since there seems to be a disconnect?
My sense, oddly enough, is anybody can figure out what I figured out, that they have to redistribute a little money if they want to keep things going for themselves. I mean, a kid playing Monopoly with his parents, if he's winning more and more, once he's winning, he's going to keep winning. But if he wants to stay up beyond his bedtime and he wants to keep the game going, he'll have to cheat by sneaking a little of his money over to his parents' side. And they can figure out that, too. And right now, we're in a strange situation where it seems like, used to be the left that said, oh, this country's going downhill, imperialism's over, blah, 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 blah. It seems to be the, if there is any consciousness, there seems to be manufacturers, business people, financiers, they're the ones who are giving up on America. They say, well, yeah, it's in a downward cycle, and they're hedging their bets. They're producing overseas, their markets are growing overseas, their capital is overseas. So absent some action by us to redistribute some of that money, mostly by better wages, it will be a kind of a downhill motion into sort of second-rate economy.
Well, Barbara Garson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Barbara Garson, the author of four books, including All the Live Long Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work, The Electronic Sweatshops, How Computers Are Transforming the Office of the Future, and Money Makes the World Go Round, One Investor Tracks Her Cash Through the Global Economy. Her latest book just out is Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was in America. A lady dressed in
the head